And good afternoon. You're listening to Kent Hudnall. This is the Kent Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. And quite an interesting place. Alright, this is October 13th, 286th day of the year. Leap year is 287th day. 79 days remain until the end of the year. On this date in history, in 54 AD, Roman Emperor Claudius dies from poisoning under very mysterious circumstances. 409, Vandals and Alans cross the Pyrenees and appear in Hispania. 1269, the present church building at Westminster Abbey is consecrated. 1307, Friday the 13th, 1307. Hundreds of Knights Templar in France are arrested at dawn by King Philip the Fair and, under torture, confess to heresy. See, Philip the Fair was in debt. Serious debt, and a lot of it to the Templars. And he decided, since he knew they had a vast treasure hidden in their commandery in Paris, that he would just destroy the order. Now, the Templars answered only to the Pope. So he went to the Pope and he said, look, here's what I want to do. And the Pope said, no. So Philip, being the enterprising individual he was, killed the Pope and replaced him with one of his own people. And the Templars were destroyed. And when he broke into the commandery, the treasure was gone. The Templar fleet that had been docked at a French port vanished, and the treasure's never been found, and the Templars, the last time they were involved on the battlefield was in Scotland. Now, 1332, Richin Bal Khan becomes the Khagan of the Mongols and Emperor of the Yan Dynasty, but he reigns for only 53 days before he is removed. 1399, coronation of Henry IV of England at Westminster Abbey. 1644, a Swedish-Dutch fleet defeats the Danish fleet at Fehmarn. Captures about 1,000 prisoners. 1710, Port Royal, the capital of French Acadia, falls in a siege by British forces. 1775, the Continental Congress establishes the Continental Navy, which later became the United States Navy. 1792 in Washington, D.C., the cornerstone of what's now known as the White House is laid. Originally, it was called the Executive Mansion, but in 1818, it was changed to the White House. I think Andrew Jackson did that. 1793, French Revolutionary War. Austro-Prussian victory over Republican France in the First Battle of Weissenburg. 1812, Sir Isaac Brock's British and native forces repel an invasion of Canada by General Unzelaer's United States forces. 1821, the Declaration of Independence of the Mexican Empire is publicly proclaimed. They broke from Spain. 1843, in New York City, B'nai B'rith, the oldest Jewish service organization in the world, is founded. 1881, first known conversation in modern Hebrew by Eliza ben Yehuda and friends. 1884, the International Meridian Conference establishes the meridian of the Greenwich Observatory as the prime meridian. And don't you know there was a lot of political maneuvering on that? 1885, the George Institute of Technology is founded in Atlanta, Georgia. One of the few things Georgia did that was good. It didn't involve screwing somebody. 1892, Edward Emerson Barnard discovers the first comet, discovered by photographic means. 1903, the Boston Red Sox win the first modern World Series, defeating the Pittsburgh Pirates in the eighth game. 1908, Margaret Travers Summons burst into the UK Parliament, becomes the first woman to speak there. They didn't quite know how to shut her up, apparently. 1911, Prince Arthur, Duke of Connacht and Strathearn, becomes the first Governor General of Canada of royal descent. 1915, the First World War. The Battle of the Hohenzollern Redoubt marks the end of the Battle of Loos. 1917, the Miracle of the Sun is witnessed by an estimated 70,000 people in the Covid era in Portugal. 1921, Soviet Republic signed the Treaty of Kars to formalize the borders between Turkey and the South Caucasus states. 1923, Ankara becomes the capital of Turkey. 1943, Marshal Pietro Badoglio announces that Italy has officially declared war on Germany. 1944, the Soviet Riga Offensive captures the city. 1946, France adopts the Constitution of the Fourth Republic. 1962, the Pacific Northwest experiences a cyclone the equal of a Category 3 hurricane and has winds up to 150 miles per hour. 46 people die. 1972, Aeroflot Flight 217 crashes outside of Moscow, kills 174. 1972, Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 crashes in the Andes Mountains. 28 survived the crash, all but 16 succumb before rescue on December 23rd. 1976, the first electron micrograph of an Ebola virus is taken at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention by Dr. F. A. Murphy. 1977, hijacking of Lufthansa Flight 181 by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. 1983, Ameritech Mobile Communications launches the first U.S. cellular network in Chicago, of all places. When they take time out from shooting each other, the folks of Chicago can do good work. 1990, Syrian forces attack free areas of Lebanon, removing General Michael Announ from the presidential palace. 2010, the mining accident in Copiapo, Chile, ends as all 33 trapped miners arrive at the surface after 69 days underground, which was a record. 2013, a stampede occurs in India during the Hindu festival Navaratri, killing 115, injuring 110 more. 2016, the Maldives announces its decision to withdraw from the Commonwealth of Nations. And in 2019, Kenyan Brigid Kosgei sets a new record for a woman runner with a time of 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 4 seconds at the 2019 Chicago Marathon. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays. Azerbaijani Railway Day in Azerbaijan. Christian Feast Day. Blessed Alexandrina of Balazar. Daniel and Companions of Quetta, Edward the Confessor, Gerald of Aurillac, Blessed Maddalena Panettiere, Theopolis of Antioch, Dotaka Matsuri in Japan, International Day for National Disaster Reduction internationally, National Police Day in Thailand, Paramedics Day in Poland, and Rwagasore Day in Burundi. Okay, let's see if we got anything else. In 54, Nero succeeds Claudius as Roman Emperor. Nero was the lunatic who fiddled as Rome burned. 1213, the Battle of the Steps. Hugh Pierrepont, Bishop of Liege, and Louis II, Count of Loon, defeat Henry I, Duke of Brabant. 1282, Nichiren Daishonin, founder of the Nichiren School of Buddhism, dies. His ashes are interred at the Tasakiji Temple. Let's see. 1399, Henry Bolingbroke is crowned King Henry IV of England. He deposed Richard II. Henry IV was known as King of England and Lord of Ireland. 1501, Maximilian of Austria and Louis XII sign a Treaty of Trent. 1534, Alessandro Farnese elected as Pope Paul III. 1660, an absolute monarchy is instituted by decree in Denmark by King Frederick III. 1716, the Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI's troops occupy Timisoara in Romania. 1773, the Whirlpool Galaxy is discovered by Charles Messier. 1792, the Old Farmer's Almanac, which is sworn by a lot of folks as I was growing up, was first published and edited by Robert Thomas in 1792. 1845, Texas ratifies a state constitution.
'Motion detected at the front door.'
Oh, yes. Whenever I get on the air, everybody and their dog shows up. 1890, the Delta Chi fraternity is founded by 11 law students at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. 1924, Mecca falls without struggle to Saudi forces led by Abdulaziz ibn Saud. He was the founder of Saudi Arabia. 1947, if you grew up when I did, a very popular show for children was Kukler, Fran, and Ollie. It actually premiered in 1947. Had Beanie the Seasick Sea Serpent. 1960, Fidel Castro executed his opponents in Cuba. If you didn't agree with him, you're gonna die. 1978, President Jimmy Carter attempted to answer callers' questions on NPR. Well, let's see. But 1981, Vice President Hosni Mubarak elected President of Egypt. That was after the killing, I think, of Sadat. He was assassinated while watching the military pass in review. 1988, the Shroud of Turin, believed by many Christians to be Christ's burial cloth, is shown by carbon dating test to be a fake from the Middle Ages. 2016, in one of the biggest mistakes made in Nobel Prize history, American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan is awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. He couldn't write. He couldn't sing. but he had the right backing. And in 2017, on this date, Rose McGowan alleges that Harvey Weinstein raped her in 1997. Okay. Okay. Well, on that note, we are going to move on to talking more about the history and mystery of El Paso. You know, if you know how to do it, you can actually become incredibly wealthy following up on these stories. Now, there was the one I was talking about when we closed yesterday was the treasure of Whistling Ghost Canyon. At the northern end of the range is a gap in the mountains where Comanches ambushed and massacred the members of a wagon train coming back from California with all the gold they had found. And the bleached human bones of the miners were found in a canyon by a trapper just south of Anthony Gap, and they laid there for many, many years. According to Charles Binion, who wrote an introduction to El Paso's scenic and historic landmarks, one of the miners is said to have escaped the massacre by climbing the wall of the canyon where the miners were defending themselves against their attackers. Headed toward what he thought was freedom and safety, walked through the night, wound up at Waco Tanks, where he met another wagon train. According to what he said, they had $250,000 in gold that they buried before they were overwhelmed by the Comanches. And though he diligently searched the area, he never was able to find the treasure. Now, sometime after 1929, all the bones were gathered and buried. And research reveals that there was some factual basis to the story. Now, the following story appeared in a 1939 article in the El Paso Times. The headline is Whistling Ghost Guard Gold in Canyon. Legend has it miners wiped out by Comanches buried the metal. Through most of the day, the rock walls fill the blind canyon with shadows. Footsteps that are a rare visitor, disturbing the tranquility of the place, echo hollowly. With the wind comes a murmurous gabbling like weird incantations. And then you can hear the eerie whistling of the ghost of the massacred California miners who lingered to guard upwards of $250,000 worth of gold they left hidden there. Now, the small canyon, long known by a few of the older residents of El Paso as the Boneyard, is situated approximately 250,000 south of Anthony Pass on the east side of Mount Franklin. And it got its name from the litter of bones that were, for many years, the tombstones of the party of miners that were killed by the Comanches back in the 1870s. Now, A.D. Hudson, El Paso dealer in semi-precious stones and semi-precious legends of the Franklin Mountains, said he first visited the Canyon of the Whistling Ghost with old Uncle George Harold, a one-time city detective and former Texas Ranger. He said the place normally has an air of melancholy and loneliness. When the wind is blowing from the right quarter, the ghost began to whistle. Now, like a man biting a dog, this tale's the reverse of the mundane visitor whistling through the cemetery. There in the canyon, the ghosts do the whistling. And according to Mr. Hudson's description, it's no place for an outing of the sons of I Will Arise. His earthly explanation for the sound is that the wind blows through the odd stone formation, giving off the mournful whistle. But the very history of the place tends to call into question such a scientific explanation. That chilling sound just literally has to be the ghosts that haunt the canyon. In the 1870s, according to Mr. Hudson, a party of 18 to 22 miners were returning east after 10 or more years in the California gold fields. With them, they had 31 head of stock. Most pack mules laden with placer gold worth only a little more than $250,000 because Mr. Roosevelt wasn't president then. West of the Franklin Mountains, the party rested and filled their canteens with water from the Rio Grande. And in wanting to get home quickly, they cut across at the old Anthony Pass rather than follow the river around the mountains. Their next stop would have been Waco Tanks, a stage station and watering place. But in the pass, the miners fell in with a war party of between 75 and 80 Comanches. They were returning victorious to Texas from a skirmish with the Cheyennes in New Mexico. And the Indians, coveting the stock that they saw the miners had, attacked, crowding them from the pass southward to the east side of the mountains. Now, the miners attempted to outrun the war party, but soon realized they'd have to abandon their pack mules and the goal. Well, not wanting to give up their hard salt wealth, they sought refuge in the Blind Canyon. Deploying over the canyon under protection of the boulders, they threw back the Indians' first attack, according to legend. And knowing the canyon was a cul-de-sac, the Comanches were content to camp and just wait. Through the first day, the miners watched the canyon mouth by turns, but with the coming of darkness, all except one stood with their rifles ready. The one exception, a man whose name was said to be Allison, scaled the walls of the canyon and set out to get aid. He was the only survivor of the massacre that followed. He walked across the flats toward Waco Tanks, and near there he collapsed and was found by immigrants who carried him east with them. Meanwhile, the other miners in the canyon were tortured by the neighing of horses and the braying of mules, already suffering from lack of water. And throughout the second day, the Indians fired down on the miners from rims of the canyon, gradually reducing their numbers, one at a time. During the third day, the miners killed their stock so it wouldn't fall into the hands of the Indians. And they themselves were beginning to suffer from thirst and were debilitated by the intense heat of the oven-like canyon. Well, when the Comanches launched their last assault, the miners took refuge in crevices and small caves, but everyone was found and killed. For many years, the skulls and bones of men, horses, and mules lay in the canyon to mark the place where they'd died. Years later, a trapper was setting a snare for game and came across the canyon with its scattered bones. Not being aware of the gold buried by the miners, he quickly moved out of the area to spread the word about what he'd found. So did these doomed miners bury over $250,000 in gold taken from the California gold fields over a 10-year period before being overrun by the Comanches? Did that trapper unknowingly walk away from a fortune in gold? According to the story, Allison returned years later in an attempt to find the gold buried by his friends, but couldn't find it. And the last piece of information I've been able to find on the treasure of Whistling Ghost Canyon is reported sometime after 1929. All the bones were collected and given a decent burial. Somewhere in that blind canyon where once men fought and died, it's said to be a fortune waiting for a lucky finder. Then there's another story about train robbers using one of the caves as their hideout. Don't have a lot of details on this one, but allegedly, the train robbers hid a lot of their ill-gotten gains in one of the caves before vacating the area for greener pastures. Now, this may be another version of the Cimarron Kate story, but due to the date of the story that I found, which was December of 1887, as well as some of the reported details, it appears to me these references are to a different group of train robbers. And as I mentioned earlier, in 1937, the WPA funded a writer's project designed to collect and preserve oral history of the pioneers who settled this country. First story was written March 15, 1937, by Ms. Marie Carter, who lived in Anthony, New Mexico. And there's an interesting part of the manuscript written by Marie Carter. She was an author working for the WPA's Writers' Project, and her complete manuscript is now archived in the Library of Congress. Now, Blythe, just so you're aware as I start to go through this, was an early name for what's now known as Chaparral. She said a short time ago, and she wrote this in 1937, I stood on Highway 54 talking to some friends at a point where tourists crossed the boundary line from Latuna, Texas to Anthony, New Mexico. And she asked a man who's only identified as Bob, "Is it true the desert east of Anthony and over the Anthony Gap is covered with grass?" He said yes. Ranchers used to graze cattle in Blythe, referring to what's now known as Chaparral. And he said, "As you know, I still believe there's gold in the Franklin Mountains. Some of the old mining men around here claim that Mount Franklin conceals a lot of lost treasure. And then there's that legend about some Indians." And he offered to tell it, and she answered that she wanted to hear it. He said, "I got this story from one of the early settlers, and he got it from a very old Mexican. Along about 1851, when James Calhoun was first governor of New Mexico, Indians were as thick as ants. One bright day, six Indians on horses and carrying several boxes of gold were seen up there in the mountains near Anthony Gap. That was the last anybody saw them until several years later. They were found dead." And she asked, "Were they the same Indians that he referred to?" And he said, "They must have been, because it was exactly six human skeletons and six horse skeletons. Whether they were robbed and murdered or murdered after they hid the gold, nobody really knows. They weren't certain just how they were murdered, but it wasn't hard to guess. Not far away, but scattered in different directions, they found some arrows which were identified as belonging to the Apaches, who were a very fierce tribe in those days. Of course, even the Apaches feared the Comanches that dominated this part of the country for some time." He said, "There's several versions of the legend of the six Indians. Some of the old-timers said there were five Indians and that they carried sacks of gold. James Calhoun, first governor of New Mexico, was appointed under the regular territorial government. He was inaugurated as governor March 5, 1851, and during his term of office had a great deal of trouble with Indian uprisings. In 1849, he was an Indian agent for New Mexico, and he died in the month of May, 1852, while en route to Washington. So who killed the six, or maybe it was five, Indians referred to in the story? Did they hide the boxes of gold before they were killed, or did their killers steal the wealth? And where did they get the gold?" That story raises quite a number of questions. Also from the WPA Writers Project is another story. I couldn't find the name of the author, but the story was recorded as told by Domencio Provincio of Anthony, New Mexico. And he told the story May 9, 1937. The author was probably Marie Carter due to the location, but I never was able to prove it. The outstanding feature of the Provincio family is their innate refinement and courtesy. And this came from the writer. "Then I called at their Spanish mission ranch home 2 miles northwest of Anthony, and Mr. Provincio related the following story. He said, I lived in New Mexico all my life. Born in the town of Omasilla, October 31st, 1872. My parents moved their family to Chamberino in 1882. But the Rio Grande, which was much more powerful than man, forced them to higher ground. So they built their town, built their home a short distance above the town at Ojito, or Little Spring, as it translated. They continued to plant their crops on the lower land, but they didn't take chances of living there because they never knew when the river was going to rise and flood them out. So the Provincio boys were brought up fighting the river. According to Nemencio, it was the big bad wolf of our lives. The Elephant Butte Dam was a godsend. Before the dam came, there was no way to control the river. It was never still, always rising and rushing and overflowing. Finally, in the year of 1892, they pulled up stakes and moved to the Anthony district. Mr. Provincio, his brother Victor, and his father, Agapio, all settled in on adjoining terrenas. Now, a terrena is an area of about 36 acres, and each settler was permitted to have a solar or building site in town if he wished it, and or to Liza and back, or an extra piece of land thrown in. And they were the first to settle on this land. It was all bosque or woodland and no ditches of any kind. Said he worked from early morning till dark, days, weeks, and months, cutting down trees, clearing the ground, building their homes, plowing and planting and fighting the Rio Grande. And it seems that the Rio Grande had a habit of taking its toll at the most unexpected times. Sometimes, he said, we'd go to bed hoping to rest after a hard day's work, only to be awakened by the lap-lap of water at our door, sometimes around their beds. The river had a voice that they grew up hating, a voice that struck terror in their hearts and souls. It was there in the rising river, increasing in volume as water rose, submerging their land, stealing their seed, quite often their homes, leaving them with nothing. The greatest surprise of the early days was the morning they awoke and found their land an island in the center of an ocean of water. The river had come up in the night and submerged the whole country. For several days, they had to go to town in rowboats. They made the first request for an irrigation ditch, and
motion detected at the front door.
When they received it, more people began to settle on the land near them. And very often, he had to assist people across the Rio Grande by swimming and leading their horses or teams. He said he used to breed horses and kept a herd up in the Franklin Mountains east of Anthony. Sometimes he'd bring several into the ranch, and when he was ready to ford the Rio Grande, he'd link them with a rope and swim across, leading the whole group. He was forced to do this to keep from losing them, for sometimes the current was so strong it would take a single horse 2 or 3 miles downstream before he could rescue him. Charlie Willer was a good friend of the early settlers. He was also a good businessman. He said Charlie never lost anything in a trade. If we borrowed 1 pound of seed from him, he got 2 in return. Built the first store on the old business street west of the Santa Fe tracks, Savina Lopez, who built the Little White Chapel northeast of Anthony in honor of San Jose, traded quite a bit of her land at Charlie's store for groceries. One time she owned 160 acres in Anthony. And talking about schools, Provencio said we didn't have any schools. Somebody started a private school, which I attended for a while, that is, till it closed because money was scarce. They used to hire out to other farmers and work all day for 50 cents. Once he got paid as much as $1.50 laying railroad track for the Southern Pacific, and he thought he was pretty rich at that point. Well, during the discussions he had with the unknown writer, Provencio said, my distant cousin, Eulogio Provencio, used to like to go camping. Usually went up to the Robledos, the mountains northwest of where they lived. And one day he came back from one of those trips and he looked very odd. Others noticed it too. Provencio said he was more curious than the others because he kept urging Eulogio to tell him why he acted so mysterious, but he wouldn't say anything. Finally, he took a man into his confidence, and they both went back up into the Robledos. When they came back, he noticed that their faces wore a look of disappointment. He wanted to know their secret so much, he almost burned to a cinder. But the Eulogio was that way. You could burn him, be damned, and he wouldn't tell you what he thought was nobody's business. But one day, Eulogio decided to enlighten Nemocio. Said, I didn't know whether to believe him or not when he told me he'd found a treasure chest in the Bolidos. So surprised, he hardly knew what to say. His lips were dry, and he had to moisten them with his tongue before he could speak. But finally, he managed to ask him how he knew it was a treasure chest. And he said his cousin had looked at him for a minute and exclaimed, Falagi Dios, don't you think I know a treasure chest? Want to see one? So this chest was heavy, so heavy I couldn't move it. Someday, I kept telling myself, I'll take tools up to the Lobledos and open it. But he kept putting it off and keeping his secret. Then he thought, maybe I'll tell somebody about it. And just as quick as I thought I would, I changed my mind and kept still. I think I was a little crazy. And I got so I couldn't sleep thinking about that treasure chest. As you know, at last I couldn't keep the secret any longer, and I took Ramon to the Lobledos with him, telling him he only wanted to show something. They kept on going, leading their pack burros up the mountain pass. He said, I guess Ramon was a little afraid of me, for I kept talking to myself about gold and how rich I was going to be. And I know he was glad when I told him we'd come to the place where I'd left the chest. And I told him to leave the bar and follow me, because, you see, I had to climb a little higher where the chest was concealed behind a clump of mesquite. Well, Ramon followed him up and found him standing there, staring like a sick man with chills and staring at the imprint of the coins in the wet sand. The chest was gone. There's a lot of stories of lost and hidden treasure. But in spite of the fact I've related a number of stories, does that mean there are not more? Well, of course not. But the question is, are the treasures real or figments of somebody's imagination? I'm reminded of a story been told to me many years ago in Florida about a buccaneer bearing a keg of gold coins near a well in a small coastal town. Everybody had heard the story numerous times, but nobody ever went looking for it, because everybody knew it was just a tall tale. Yes, it was a tall tale till the young man took his brand new metal detector and went searching around that old well. A lot of people laughed at him, but they stopped laughing when he dug up that keg of gold coins exactly where the old story said it would be buried. What he found that afternoon paid for his college education, gave him a good start in his own business. His friends may have laughed at him, but he laughed at them all the way to the bank. Well, another interesting feature about the Franklin Mountains is the large representation of a thunderbird that can be seen on the west side of the mountains. Now, scientists, of course, in their brilliance from their air-conditioned laboratories, say it's just a natural phenomena. But if it is, why does it support ancient Indian legends? This was discussed in a 1995 story that appeared in the El Paso Times. According to the headline, Thunderbird Moves Closer to Protection. House to vote on land swap for mountain image by Victor Martinez. To many West El Pasoans, the large red rock formation on the Franklin Mountains represents the power and grace of the legendary Thunderbird. According to Virginia native Sam Strickland, when he first moved here, he thought some Coronado High School kids just painted the mountain red in the shape of the Thunderbird, seeing it's their mascot and all. But the image on the west side of the Franklin Mountains is not the work of vandals. No, it's the work of nature. And in-state Senator Peggy Ralston, Democrat of El Paso, made the comment she hopes it stays that way. See, she did sponsor a bill that would allow the State Parks and Wildlife Department to trade land in another part of the state with the General Land Office to make sure the Thunderbird is part of the Franklin Mountain State Park and protect it from development. According to Natalie Scott, Rosen's legislative aide, Rosen felt strongly that portion of the mountain needs to be included in the park because it's a very special piece of land. See, the land swap bill passed the Texas Senate May 10th, 1995. The bill is currently being reviewed by a House subcommittee. It should be presented to the House for final approval on Monday, according to the story. The land office now leases the Franklin Mountains parcel to the Parks Department. But ownership was scheduled to revert to the land office in 96 with the option to sell the land to developers. Now, University of Texas and El Paso geologist says the Thunderbird seen on the mountain was made of iron oxide created 1.1 billion years ago when the mountain sedimentary rock began to erode and ultimately expose the red tint. It's very much like putting something metal out in the sun and watching it rust, a geology professor said. You can see the Thunderbird formation very clearly because it's surrounded by gray limestone that gives it that striking appearance. Now, the formation on the mountain inspired Coronado High School to claim the Thunderbird as its mascot. In 1976, Coronado High School's graduating class persuaded the General Land Commission and city to protect the formation by making it a wilderness area. Well, the question becomes, is the Thunderbird a real creature or a mythical animal? What exactly is the Thunderbird? And why does almost every Native American culture have legends regarding a monstrous bird? Now, the scientists all say this thunderbird on the mountain is an accident of nature. But is it? Before completely consigning the thunderbird to the realm of fiction, there's a story that I found about this inhabitant of the sky. I discovered that there are people and websites dedicated to the study of creatures that don't exist, but actually do. It's a field of study called cryptozoology. And the best history of the Thunderbird is one that I found on a website dedicated to the study of these creatures. According to the website, whatever type of creature is referred to as a Thunderbird is certainly real. Most descriptions talk of a huge reptilian creature that dominated the skies of the American Southwest. Unfortunately, like many legends told by the Native American cultures, the legend of the Thunderbird is considered a complete myth by most serious researchers. And this is a pity and certainly underrates the observation skills of a culture that originally settled and populated this land prior to the arrival of the Pilgrims or the Spanish. The story of the Thunderbird dates back prior to the earliest days of the Spanish conquest. According to the story reported on TrueAuthority.com, while exploring the Sonora Desert in February 12, 1699, Captain Juan Mateo Manje, accompanied by Jesuits Eusebio Francisco Quino and Adam Gill, were told by the Pima Indians that a giant monster lived in a cave nearby in days past. They reported that creature was a horror to the people because it would fly around and catch as many Indians as it could and make a meal out of them. Well, when Captain Manje tried to gain more information about this creature, he was told that on one occasion after the creature had eaten its fill, some men followed it back to its cave, and while the creature was asleep, they closed the entrance to the cave with wood collected specifically for this occasion. Then they set it on fire, and as the creature couldn't escape, it growled fiercely, dying from asphyxiation as a result of the flames and the smoke. Another Pima reported the story of... Well, as I've said, anybody who wants to try to sell something, especially right now with all this, everybody advertising for their candidates, they show up at my front door. Now, according to the Pima Indians, there was a similar animal in the Pueblo of Opusura that was killed using a similar tactic. And there's a record the actual bones of this creature were found during the pacification of Mexico by General Don Hernando Cortez and sent to Spain. So if in fact we're talking about, let's just say, a pterodactyl, which is what many people think the Thunderbird may have been, the bones were packed on a ship and sent across the ocean. Now, stories of these flying creatures are prevalent among many other Indian tribes in the American Southwest, suggesting they had a long history of encounters with creatures reminiscent of the pterosaur, especially the gigantic pterodon, or pteranodon, I guess it is. Of course, according to the theory of evolution, this couldn't be a dinosaur or a flying reptile. They all died off 65 million years ago, long before man walked upright. But remember, the coleocanth, which was supposedly extinct 65 million years ago, was caught in 1939. In a fishnet off the coast of Africa. As the Spanish conquistadors pushed further into new territory, one tribe after another told similar stories about these creatures. The fierce Yaqui Indians told of a giant bird that lived on the hill of Otoncawe. Every morning it left its nest to capture another human to eat for its breakfast. Once having captured its prey, the giant bird would return to the nest and rest till the next time it was hungry. One young boy who supposedly lost his entire family to the creature finally went after it with a bow and arrow and killed it. And as the Spanish moved ever northward, they came in contact with the great warriors of the plain, the Sioux. And even these mighty lords of the north had terrifying experiences with the great Thunderbird that sent fear into their fierce hearts. They told the Spanish a story of an incident with a Thunderbird that coincided perfectly with the description of the Pteranodon. According to the Sioux, one day long ago, before the white man came to America, a party of Sioux warriors was out hunting. They wandered far from their village and their usual hunting grounds, found themselves in the bare, rocky badlands of the West. And as they rode along, the sky suddenly darkened and there was a loud clap of thunder that shook the earth. Looking up, they saw the shape of a giant bird falling toward the earth. Well, fearful of what it was, but curious at the same time, the hunting party traveled over the Badlands for days till they got to the spot where they believed the giant bird hit the ground. Now, they found nothing but bare bones. But even the bones had the power to cause fear. The bird hit the ground so hard that its bones were partly sunk into the rock. But even in its present condition, the warriors could see the wingspan was as big as four big tall men standing one on top of the other. And the creature had sharp claws on its wings as well as on its feet, and the beak was long and sharp. There was a long bony crest on its head. It was a creature unlike any they had ever seen before. Well, as the Spanish pushed further north in their greedy search for gold, they met the Indians of Illinois, called the Aleni. This tribe was once terrorized by a large bird they called the Piassa, which means bird that devours man. And they said the monstrous Piassa was so big and powerful it could allegedly carry off a full-grown deer. Every Indian tribe in that area feared the Piassa and sought to destroy it. One day the Aleni are said to have tricked the creature by hiding 20 armed warriors in a certain spot while the chief himself chose to stand out in the open, offering himself as a victim for the Piassa. As the bird swooped in to attack, the man in hiding jumped out and speared it to death. So what was the Piassa? Many speculate it to be the imagination of superstitious natives. Others believe it may have been a large condor, and others believe it could have been an actual flying reptile. 1848, John Russell, a writer from Illinois who was interested in the Piassa, explored the cage where the creature was said to live. After his exploration, he found one cave particularly difficult to access that revealed evidence supporting the Aleni story. He said the shape of the cave was irregular, but so far as I could judge, the bottom would average 20 to 30 by 30 feet. And the floor of that cave throughout the whole extent was one mass of human bones. And out in Illinois, for long anybody could remember, a painting existed high up on a cliff. Though destroyed in the 1850s when the face of the cliff collapsed into the river, a number of explorers during the 17th and 18th century saw the painting and described what it looked like in great detail in their journals. The description was of a bird-like animal with many reptilian characteristics. According to some, the first account of the Piassa paintings came in the late 17th century when Father Marquette recorded in his journal strange observations he made during an exploratory trip by canoe down the Mississippi. Now, that he was a reliable observer is not open to question. His writings have remained to the present time as important and credible references to scholars studying customs and culture of the Indians when the white man first arrived. According to his account, while skirting some rocks, which by their height and length inspired awe, we saw upon one of them two painted monsters that at first made us afraid, and by which the boldest savages dare not long rest their eyes. They were as large as a calf, have horns on their heads like those of a deer, a horrible look, red eyes, a beard like a tiger's, a face somewhat like a man's, a body covered with scales, and a tail so long that it winds all the way around the body, passing above the head and going back between the legs, ending up in a fish tail. Green, red, and black were the three colors composing the picture. Moreover, these two monsters are so well painted, we can't believe any savage as their author, for good painters in France would find it difficult to do so well. Besides, they're so high up on the rock, it's difficult to reach that place conveniently to paint them. Well, the Ho and the Colleto Indians told of a giant bird so big that its wingspans are twice the size of their war canoes. The creature was described as having great claws, a long beak, and the ability to actually pluck whales out of the sea. There's even a legend that Thunderbird plucked a very large whale from the sea and carried him to Beaver Prairie, where the creature began to try and eat the whale. And this powerful whale, though out of water, still waged a great struggle for survival. In the battle, legend says the two mighty creatures pulled up every tree by its roots. And as a result, to this day, no trees grow in Beaver Prairie. Now, the Indians of Mexico and South America also have stories about these great birds. Jose Diaz Bolillo, an archaeologist from Mexico, found an ancient Maya relief sculpture in Veracruz, Mexico, showing a bird-like creature similar to Pteranodon. In November 1968, Science Digest, Dr. Diaz Bolillo wrote an article entitled Serpent Bird of the Mayas. According to Dr. Diaz Bolillo, the bird is not merely the product of Mayan flights or fancy, but a realistic representation of an animal that lived during the period of the ancient Mayans, 1,000 to 5,000 years ago. Missionaries had come out of South American jungles with stories told by the natives of giant birds that closely resembled pterosaurs. In Venezuela, the Yeks have a story centuries old of a giant man-eating bat that lived at the headwaters of the river in a cave on a mountain. This creature would periodically attack canoes on the river and carry off the people it could capture. Eventually, men were chosen to track and kill the creature, which they did successfully. Further detail of the story was that since the giant creature defecated in the river, the natives would never drink water from that river. And another tribe, the Carolinian, also had stories about an enormous gliding serpent. So what was the Thunderbird, and what does that have to do with the Franklin Mountains? Well, the stories told by the Indians in northern Mexico pointed to the Franklins as a home of this monstrous killer. The interesting thing is that when Indians attacked the lair of this creature, they were able to kill it. Rather, they sealed it into the mountain and placed a sign on the mountain marking the prison of this gigantic immortal beast. And woe be unto him who frees the Thunderbird, because he'll be responsible for death and destruction far beyond anything mankind has yet experienced. So there you have it. In Franklin Mountain Range lays a most mysterious natural anomaly, Thunderbird Mountain, that takes its name from the gigantic, amazing Thunderbird-shaped natural formation of red clay on the mountainside. In keeping with the legends of the mountain being a prison for this strange creature, the unusual formation has been there as long as anybody can remember, watching over the southwestern desert. So does the mysterious Thunderbird dwell in the mountain range? Its presence in the red clay of the mountainside is unmistakable. Guarding the desert landscape, wings outstretched, head turned to the side, an immense mythical silhouette. Now before we go, let's take one more legend about the giant Thunderbird. American Indian legends hold that the mammoth bird dwells in the mountains. When it comes out to hunt, it stirs up violent thunderstorms in its wake, lightning flashes from its razor-sharp beak, and thunderclaps sound from its massive wing beats. The old stories say the Thunderbird dominated the sky, cloaked in thick rolling storm clouds. It devoured killer whales, swooping down to the water to pluck them up with his great talons. It was both feared and revered by the early inhabitants of the North American continent. Some claim the Thunderbird legend is based in reality. In fact, there have been many giant bird sightings throughout history. Some even claim that these huge mystery birds have carried off small children. So what is the Thunderbird exactly? Fanciful legend or cryptozoological mystery? Well, who can say? But just to be on the safe side, don't go digging around near the Thunderbird on Thunderbird Mountain, because who knows what you might find. Well, on the other side of Thunderbird Mountain is something equally mysterious, the Mexican poppy field. Every spring, these bright flowers cover the desert floor at the base of the Franklins like a lush yellow carpet as far as the eye can see. Now, nobody knows how these gorgeous blossoms got there, though there are many, many theories. Some say they were planted by U.S. Army National Guard troops from nearby Fort Bliss many years ago. Others claim the fields were seeded by air in the 1920s and 30s to create a tourist attraction. And there's even a theory that a truckload of sheep from California were let loose in the fields to graze many years ago, where they deposited the California poppy seeds that they had eaten. Either way, they've been blooming as long as anybody can remember. Also, some interesting ruins to be found in the poppy field, such as the remains of a stick hut and the foundation of an old casita. Also, a rather sinister-looking water fountain with some sort of grotesque creature standing guard. Fort Bliss has an artillery range, Kastner Range, on the outskirts of the fields, which makes for some kind of funny yet disturbing warning signs. and always in the distance, towering, watching, waiting. You see the majestic Franklin's looming above all, home to many strange and mysterious legends. And before we close, I've got one last story of the strange and unusual to tell, which comes from the website entry called Lost Destinations. According to this story, the people telling it, their parents used to drive them up there for a thrill when they were kids. The person telling the story, sister, brother, cousins, all pile into the back seat and cling to one another in breathless anticipation as the car wound up and around the mountain, coming ever nearer to the dark, dead end of the road, which dropped off sharply down the face of the mountain. And at the end of that road, clinging to the mountainside, rose the house. Well, according to the person telling the story, their father would have invariably feign a breakdown right in front of the house, and they fell for it every time. They'd sit squealing in delighted terror as their father attempted to start the stalled car while acting like he was seeing things coming toward him from the haunted house. Many times she remembered seeing candlelight moving from window to window behind the tattered curtains as someone or something was moving restlessly in that dark house watching them. Their father'd always get the car started just in time and speed off down the mountain, and they'd feel like they'd just outrun spooks from a horror movie. Now, they were never actually sure what exactly haunted that house. It was a mystery. Some said in early years, a satanic cult occupied that house and held rituals inside. Rituals that invoked demonic forces that never quite left the house. Neighbors complained of hearing strange chanting coming from inside the house late at night, and a lot of them claimed to have seen robed figures. In later years, it was said the place was home to an evil, wrinkled old crone who practiced the black arts. The rumor was that many kids would try the old ding-dong ditch routine at the house, and a few of the unlucky ones weren't fast enough to escape, ended up being grabbed and dragged back into the house by the old witch, never to be seen again. In fact, the teller of the story had one brave, or was it dumb, teenage cousin who actually tried that. It was on Halloween. They were parked down the street because it didn't dare go any closer, and the cousin walked the rest of the way to the house. A minute later, she came flying back down the steep road, jumped into the car, babbling the whole time about a scary-looking old woman. She says she stood on the front doorstep trying to work up the courage to ring the bell, and the door flew open, and the witch grabbed her by the wrist and tried to pull her inside. She says she jerked free and ran for her life. And she was quite shaken up and even showed long red scratches on her arm where the witch had grabbed her. Well, they all teased her about it for years and thought she probably just made it up to scare them. She still swears she wasn't making it up, but then again, who knows? Either way, the experience just added to their sense of awe and fear toward the place. Well, they were doing some excavation in that area over 15 years later. Up the mountain, slightly behind and to the right from where the house is, when they found a mass grave of bodies on the mountainside. And as soon as everybody heard it on the news, they drove out to where the bodies were found out of morbid curiosity. The teller of the story remembered seeing the yellow crime scene tape wrapped around the area and watching them carry body bag after body bag down from the mountain. They never really determined where the bodies came from. But being such an old, historically rich area, they could have come from anywhere. The popular legend was they were the bodies of the missing children grabbed by the witch, or sacrificial victims of the devil worshippers that used to live in the house. But it was all speculation. The stories about the house are quite old. Their parents were telling them about them when they were told about them when they were young kids. The house had been there for countless years. It was even abandoned for quite a few years, fueling the whole haunted house rumor. So who knows what the real treasure is or what the real truth is. Now, anybody knows it was a very creepy place back then. Now, the house was still standing at the time I wrote this, and it's just been taken over by someone who's fixed it up quite a lot. Doesn't look near as scary as it used to, but memories don't go away. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's short story. Tomorrow we'll be talking about haunted schools in El Paso. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.